Rivets Under the Bridge. When she was less than 2 weeks old, a viral infection of the heart nearly killed my daughter, Catherine. While still in pediatric intensive care, she survived her third heart failure the night my father died. At that moment, fatherhood became a stumbling trek, jerked along as though still in the staccato pattern of Catherine's heart monitor. 6 weeks later, she pulled through and was discharged. I went from autopilot to a Janus-faced dad, one face looking toward Catherine, to the ministrations of medications, monitoring of her color, temperature, and pulse, and scheduling of time for the countless sessions of physical and speech therapy. The other face looked in the opposite direction to attend to Alana, Catherine's 4-year-old sister, who needed a different kind of loving care. She was bombarded by demands no one her age should have to cope with. A dying baby sister, the death of her grandfather, all in a few months. Worse still, Catherine's mother, Linda, and I frequently had to leave Alana with friends to visit medical specialists or get lab work done for Catherine. Bright and articulate, Alana seemed to absorb the emotional beating she was taking, but signs of stress soon popped up. One afternoon, Linda and I found time to dedicate to Alana. Relishing our presence, Alana began to dance for Linda and me in the living room. We were her audience, seated on the sofa, giving her our undivided attention at last. She strode into the room, proud and upbeat, in her favorite raspberry leotard. She twirled, arms out at her side, her head cocked back, dancing a made-up dance. She spun around in lazy circles and began to sing. The first and only line in her song sent my heart through the floor. "My beautiful world is falling apart," she sang. She turned repeatedly around the room, singing with a bright smile on her face, with no apparent recognition of the gravity of her words. "My beautiful world is falling apart." Several weeks later, Linda found Alana playing a hopping game in her bedroom. Alana explained she was hopping from island to island because, she said, "there are crocodiles in the water between the islands." Linda read the signs and arranged for Alana to see a child psychiatrist. She described him as a talking doctor. Seeing a shrink at the age of 4 was unusual in those days. To my father, it would have been unthinkable. I had seen a psychologist 20 years earlier in graduate school to help me manage turbulent emotions after returning from the Peace Corps. Dad had looked askance. He had asked, "What good will it do?" Alana's talking doctor lived in Sausalito, a 45-minute drive from Berkeley, and the biweekly trip offered an opportunity for Alana and me to escape the drumbeat of medicines, labs, and hospital visits for her sick sister. We eagerly sought to rediscover the magic that Alana and I had invented on playgrounds, at the beach, during picnics in her first years before Catherine. On her visits to the talking doctor, we would piggyback an outing together. The wheels of our Datsun made a crunching sound as they rolled over the mixed gravel at the house of Dr. S. "Here we are, honey," I murmured. Alana opened her eyes and lifted her arms as if on cue from her proto-meditation. Often during the drives, she would fall half asleep, but was quick to lift her arms when I opened the car door upon arriving. I unbuckled her chair belt and lifted her out of the car. We strode together to an open gate at the entry of Dr. S.'s office. "I'll be right here," I said quietly, following our routine. Without a word, she traced the short path to the sliding door where the talking doctor was waiting. An hour later, she came trotting out, a bit of a bounce in her step. She seemed refreshed. She was ready for our adventure. "Where shall we go, Daddy?" she asked, her face wide open, eyes sparkling under arching eyebrows. "What did you decide?" "I have a special place, a secret place, a place we've never been to before," I announced. She looked up with anticipation. "It's a place almost nobody knows about. We're going to the bridge, under the bridge." She beamed as I lifted her into her seat behind mine. "We can go under the bridge?" "Yes, I know a secret way." Then, haltingly, I asked, "Did you enjoy your hour, Dr. S?" Part of me wanted a glimpse of where Dr. S was going with Alana. What was he finding out? But I was questioning myself as well. Was this really the direction I wanted to go? "We played with stickers," she said. "I told Dr. S a story with the stick-ons."
"Did you tell him about our afternoon?"
"I didn't know we were going under the bridge," she said.
I paused, glancing in the rearview mirror, fumbling inside. Probe more or be the playmaster?
"Yep, under," I said.
Alana had been over the Golden Gate many times, and we always loved to poke around the Presidio, Fort Point, and the beach at Land's End. At the time, I thought that crawling around under the gigantic structure would be like no other jungle gym she had ever seen. Looking back now, perhaps in my subconscious, we would both feel some solace about a part of the world that stays in place, immutable, a spot that has weathered many storms. Parking at Fort Point, I found my old passage behind the fort, a place I had visited often as a graduate student in the 1960s. In those days, it was possible to scale the steep, grassy slopes and wind one's way to a point directly under the span.
"Let's go straight up here, honey,"
I beckoned to her, extending my hand as we started up the steep slope. The air was clear and crisp. The wind made our cheeks rosy. Up we went, holding hands, laughing and giggling, our excitement rising with each step up the grassy hillside. The undercarriage of the bridge dominated our view. Out through the latticework, we could see the afternoon sun shimmering on the Pacific. The steel girders of the huge structure soared high above us. We stood like Lilliputians beneath it.
"Can you see the top, Alana?"
"I can only see the bottom," she said,
peering up into the masses of marine oxide, reddish-orange. The cars made muted whooshes hundreds of feet above us.
"Look, Daddy," she exclaimed, "a radio."
A small transistor lay in the grass, battered and forgotten.
"And there's a doll."
She scampered over to a weathered Raggedy Ann that lay forlornly nearby. We poked around at the footings of the crisscrossing beams. A blanket of urban detritus lay strewn about, undisturbed after a long fall. Car radio antennas, plastic bags, pieces of someone's diary, a woman's address written on a corner of a piece of paper, a lighter, discarded rivets. A small gathering of trash and treasures had made the same fateful drop from high above, each with a story contained in or about it, waiting patiently to be discovered, perhaps to be put back together.
"What are these big things, Daddy?"
Alana said, pointing at some of the rivets lying in the grass.
"They're called rivets. They're like pegs to hold pieces of steel together, like this bridge." "They must be magic to hold this giant thing," she said, waving at the bridge.
Nearly an inch thick, some a half foot long, many broken and jagged, rivets lay in disorder across the hillside. Their surfaces looked worn, as though they deserved a rest after a long life of service. Most were fractured, as if having been misstruck. Faded red oxide paint covered their round heads, matching the strong hue of the mother bridge.
"Oh, they're heavy,"
Alana said, picking one up. "So right you are, little one. These pegs hold together all those big pieces that go from there to there, up and down and across," I said, pointing up to the crossbeams. The heads of the rivets in the bridge formed long, even lines and massive patterns at the intersections of the beams. On the giant girders of the bridge, they formed a soft evenness, as though they had been sewn into the steel. I marveled at their millions, holding that conglomeration of metal above us. I stared up blankly. Where are my rivets? Where do I find rivets to keep my world together? The seismic waves of Catherine's illness had stressed the trusses holding up our lives. I could see no way to repair them.
"Can we take some home?" Alana asked. "The holding together things?"
"The rivets? Great idea," I replied.
"Let's pick out three or four of the best. You pick three, I will too."
We poked around, bending over to sort through the rivets, selecting the ones with the most paint.
"This is like Easter eggs," Alana squealed as she darted around.
The bay air was beginning to cool in the late afternoon, and we made our way back down the hill, many pounds of rivets pulling on my backpack. At the foot of the hill, we spotted an open gate to Fort Point, a large fort built before the Civil War, now dwarfed and tucked under the bridge, which was erected 70 years later. With daylight still left, we clambered up its walls and steps to a small wooden lookout nestled high on the fort wall. "Your castle, my princess," I exclaimed, with my hand extended outward towards the sea. Alana beamed and, with fresh energy, ran up to me on the parapet walkway and threw her arms around my legs, giving them a tight hug.
"I love being under the bridge, Daddy,"
her head arched up, eyes glistening with joy. That's when it hit me. I had taken my 4-year-old to a psychiatrist, and here she was giving me therapy. Alana was my magical holding-together thing, a small rivet for me and the family. "And I love you, sweetheart," I murmured, my arms pulling her close. Nearest, a large window of the lookout lay open, facing west. Solid beams of honey sunlight bathed the surroundings. I sat Alana on the sill, a few rivets in her lap, and snapped a last photo for the day. With the sun setting behind us, we repeated our loading-up procedure in the Datsun and headed home, a collection of unlikely marine oxide treasures nestled in the seat.